From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
خودشون به بهانه اینکه صدام بمب شیمیایی داره برای حمله کردن.
It's regrettable that the same people who gave Saddam chemical material to make his bombs used his possession of chemical, you know, weapons as a disguise to attack him.
During the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s, over 1 million people were killed. As we continue our week-long series, Remembering the Dead, we'll look at how the Reagan administration armed Iran and Iraq with Nobel Peace Prize winner Shireen Ebadi and journalist Alan Friedman. But first, Attorney General John Ashcroft refuses to release memos detailing U.S. torture policy.
I have not invoked executive privilege today. I have explained to you why I'm not turning over the documents.
Well, what are you invoking?
I have not invoked anything. I have just explained to you why I'm not turning over the documents.
Thank you very much. Well, General, that means you may be in contempt of Congress then.
Today, we'll look at how the Bush administration is justifying torture with attorney Michael Ratner.
The president's lawyers say he can use the Pinochet defense, torture in the name of national security.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. By a unanimous vote, the UN Security Council okayed a new Iraq resolution that recognizes the new unelected interim government in Iraq while allowing the U.S. to maintain its force of 138,000 troops in the country. The U.S. will maintain control over its forces but agree to confer with the Iraqi Governing Council over sensitive offensive operations. While President Bush hailed the UN resolution as a, quote, great victory for the Iraqi people, some fear it could break the country apart. Kurdish political leaders are now threatening to pull out of the government because the UN resolution abandons a provision of the interim Iraqi constitution that gave the Kurds veto power over new laws. The New York Times is reporting the new appointed Iraqi Prime Minister, Iyad Alawi, helped the CIA carry out a series of bombings in Iraq during the 1990s, including possibly one attack that targeted a movie theater filled with civilians. The CIA worked with Alawi's exile organization, the Iraqi National Accord, to sabotage Saddam Hussein's government. The Times based its report on interviews with former CIA officials who gave conflicting accounts of how effective and how lethal the attacks were. Alawi, who also has ties to British and Saudi intelligence, is not believed to have ever spoken publicly about the terror campaign. But one former member of the Iraqi National Accord came forward in 1996 and described himself as the group's chief bomb maker, and he admitted carrying out the attacks. Attorney General John Ashcroft rejected calls by Congress on Tuesday to discuss or release secret government memos that reportedly determined the Bush administration could ignore domestic and international laws and allow U.S. interrogators to torture detainees. According to news reports, one 50-page Justice Department memo said inflicting physical or psychological pain might be justified if it was done in order to, quote, prevent further attacks on the United States by the Al-Qaeda terrorist network. The administration's support for the use of torture has been widely criticized by human rights groups. Today, several of the country's major newspapers weigh in with editorial. The Washington Post writes, quote, theirs is the logic of criminal regimes, of dictatorships around the world that sanction torture on grounds of national security. One of the country's leading manufacturers of electronic voting machines, Diebold, has announced it's banning its senior executives from making donations to political candidates. The company has come under intense criticism for its ties to the Republican Party. Its chair and CEO, Walden O'Dell, wrote a letter last year to potential supporters of President Bush in which he said he was, quote, committed to helping Ohio deliver its electoral votes to the president next year. O'Dell also held a $1,000 a plate Republican fundraiser at his home in Columbus. Critics of electronic voting machines fear the presidential election could be fixed if electronic voting machines are used, especially if they're being operated by such partisan companies. In other voting news, the chair of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission is expected to propose a series of recommendations today to his fellow commissioners to help increase voter confidence in electronic voting machines before the presidential election. According to the New York Times, the commissioner will call on makers of voting machines to allow elections officials to examine their source code, ask elections officials to publicly outline what measures are being taken to ensure security of their systems, and have voting software companies submit their software to review to the National Software Reference Library. An American working for the Vanel Corporation was shot and killed in the Saudi capital of Riyadh Tuesday. Last year, seven workers for Vanel died in an attack on a housing compound that killed a total of 35 people. Since 1975, Vanel has been paid to help train and arm the Saudi National Guard, whose main job is to protect the Saudi monarchy from domestic attacks. Vanel is also working in Iraq, helping to train the new Iraqi army. Since May 1st, 28 foreigners have been killed in Saudi Arabia. CNN's reporting a new poll in Saudi Arabia has found that almost half of all Saudis have a favorable view of Osama bin Laden. At the G8 meetings in Georgia, a group of Arab leaders has rejected an invitation from President Bush to meet today for lunch with G8 leaders. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Morocco all turned down the invitation. Morocco and Egypt claimed there were scheduling issues. The U.S. is trying to push the G8 to pass a measure calling for more democratic reforms in the Middle East. In Israel, two members of Prime Minister General Ariel Sharon's government have resigned, said they would oppose his government, bringing Sharon's government closer to collapse. In Venezuela, the Elections Council announced Tuesday a presidential recall referendum will be held on August 15th to determine if President Hugo Chavez stays in power. If he's defeated in the recall, presidential elections will be held within 30 days. The Nation's reporting the chief Latin American expert at the Council on Foreign Relations has quit under pressure from associates of former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. The scholar, Kenneth Maxwell, had been the target of Kissinger after he reviewed a new book titled The Pinochet File that examines the U.S. role in the Chilean coup that overthrew the democratically elected leader Salvador Allende and put in place the military dictator Augusto Pinochet. In his review of the book, Maxwell concluded there was, quote, deep involvement of the U.S. intelligence services in Chile prior to and after the coup. The book, written by Peter Kornbluh, is based on 25,000 declassified U.S. documents. Maxwell's review, which appeared in the journal Foreign Affairs, outraged associates of Kissinger, most notably William Rogers, the former Assistant Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs under Kissinger, and a vice president of his consulting firm, Kissinger Associates. After both Maxwell and Rogers fired responses back and forth in the pages of Foreign Affairs, the debate was stopped. Maxwell accused Kissinger and Rogers of pressuring the council and the journal from ending the debate. The author of the Pinochet book, Peter Kornbluh, also became involved when Foreign Affairs refused to allow him to publish a letter to the editor. In San Francisco, 150 protesters were arrested Tuesday outside a major biotech conference. Over 1,000 people marched in the city against the use of genetically modified food, cloning, and biotech drugs.
That's all we ask in our country dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. We as the young wish to say in this song, God bless great America. We give thanks to the old for achieving their goal. It is now up to us, and we know we must build up a trust. And we want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. Power for the people. Power for the people.
Curtis Mayfield, Power for the People, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the largest public media collaboration in the country, broadcasting on over 220 public radio and television stations, as well as on Free Speech TV, channel 9415 of Dish Network. I'm Amy Goodman. Attorney General John Ashcroft is refusing to release or discuss memos detailing U.S. torture as lawmakers accused him of trying to hide how the Bush administration has justified the abuse of prisoners. The administration has come under fire from human rights groups and military lawyers in recent days for concluding 2 years ago that it could ignore international and domestic laws and allow U.S. soldiers to torture detainees. A series of leaked memos published in the press this week outline how lawyers for the administration determined U.S. soldiers could torture detainees during interrogations by claiming it was in the interest of national security. The memos indicate that lawyers from the Pentagon, as well as the Justice Department and the White House and the Vice President's office, backed the policy changes. During 3 hours of testimony before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday, Attorney General John Ashcroft refused to provide copies of the memos in a session marked by several sharp exchanges. During the hearing, Ashcroft came under questioning from Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy.
In the front page of the Times, it has this quote, a team of administration lawyers concluded in a March 2000 late legal memorandum that President Bush was not bound either by international treaty prohibiting torture or by federal anti-torture law because he has the authority as commander-in-chief to approve any techniques needed to protect the nation's security. Do you agree with that conclusion?
Senator Kennedy, I'm not going to try and issue hypothetical.
I'm not asking hypothetical. This is a memoranda that again was referred today in the Post. August 2002, Justice Department advised the White House that torturing al-Qaeda terrorists in captivity abroad may be justified and that international laws against torture may be unconstitutional if applied to interrogations. Do you agree with that?
I am not. First of all, this administration rejects torture.
I'm asking you whether this is. There are three memoranda. January 9, 2002, signed by John Yeo. The August 2002 Justice Department, the Bybee Amendment memo, and the March 2003, the Interagency Working Group. Those are three memoranda. Will you provide those to the committee?
No, I will not.
Attorney General John Ashcroft and Senator Ted Kennedy at the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee hearing yesterday in July 2002, just 1 month before the August memo referred to by Kennedy. The U.S. opposed a United Nations draft international treaty against torture that had taken a decade to negotiate. The treaty would have set up an international system of inspections for all sites where prisoners were held to ensure that torture was not taking place. Kennedy continued to press Ashcroft to release the memos when he was yielded the floor by Delaware Senator Joseph Biden. This is Kennedy.
General, has the president authorized you to invoke the executive privilege today on these documents?
I am not going to revealed discussions, whether I've had them or not had them with the president. He asked me to deal with him as a matter of confidence. I have not invoked executive privilege today. I have explained to you why I'm not turning over the documents.
Well, what are you invoking?
I have not invoked anything. I have just explained to you why I'm not turning over the documents.
Thank you very much. Well, General, that means you may be in contempt of Congress then. You got to have a reason not to answer our questions. As you know, when you're sitting up here, there may be a rationale for executive privilege that misses the point. But you know, you have to have a reason. You are not allowed under our Constitution not to answer our questions. And that ain't constitutional.
Senator Biden and Senator Kennedy taking on Attorney General John Ashcroft in the Senate hearing yesterday. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to Attorney Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me, Amy.
Can you talk about these memos?
Well, these memos are extraordinary. When the Center for Constitutional Rights got the April memo of 2003, we were just... popped our eyes out, because what it says is really something I never expected to see. It says that the president in his commander-in-chief powers is exempt from laws in the United States that prohibit torture, is exempt from the torture convention, which the United States ratified, and as commander-in-chief, he can basically take whatever actions he wants to defend the United States. I call that the Pinochet defense. I call it the Troy argument, that you can essentially sack a city, kill all the men, sell everybody into slavery. If you can do anything, that's what he can do. So it basically turns on its head 1,000 years of law, and it just makes you think, what was the annex attached to that document? That document had an annex of what the interrogation techniques were supposed to be. That's one of the issues that came up in the hearing with Ashcroft yesterday, and that's what we want to see.
And that's what Ashcroft was refusing to show?
Among other things, that was one of the critical documents, is those interrogation techniques, which everybody now in the press, all of a sudden, of course, compared to 2 years ago when we knew about some of this torture, now all of a sudden the press is all over this trying to get that document. But Ashcroft so far has refused it. It's an important document. It's not the end-all and the be-all, but it's going to show at least a number of the techniques that I believe will constitute torture.
Why was he refusing to show them? On what grounds is this contempt of Congress?
Well, there is, as was explained in the hearing, you have to take executive privilege to not turn it over. He didn't do that.
Why? So why didn't he? What was the point? What would that invoke once he did that?
Well, then he would say it was part of the executive holding a document, as opposed to him himself, the president, saying, I have a right to hold this document. That doesn't mean he could hold it in all cases, but at least it sets up the privilege. It can be overcome. If Nixon had tried to withhold the Watergate tapes, the court then said you have to turn them over. Not a valid invocation of the privilege. But he didn't even get there. So what's really going on here? What's really going on here is an incredible cover-up of illegality by our government at the highest levels, in my belief.
So this memo comes out. We've got memo from Justice Department, memo from the Pentagon. How high up does it go? Who approved this?
Well, this memo has Rumsfeld's name on the cover. It also says something really interesting. If our soldiers or if our people are going to do this kind of conduct, it might be best to shield them with a presidential order or directive. So it indicates on page 24 of the document that a presidential directive would be very helpful here. So that's the other document you want to see here. Is there a presidential directive? Look, it's not going to say go torture people, but in my view, it may very well say these are techniques that are authorized to be used, which many lawyers will then say constitute either torture or cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment. It's an extraordinary memo. If people want to see it, we have it linked on our website as a PDF file. It's ccr-ny.org. You can go there, look at pages 21 to 24. If you think this country is going in a bad way, this will confirm your worst fears.
If the memo says that the president can claim to be able to ignore laws regarding torture on the grounds of national security, what other laws could he ignore?
Well, it actually goes farther than that. It says the president is exempt from all criminal laws in the United States with regard to when he has the commander-in-chief power fighting a war. In other words, he's exempt from all law, which is why the example of what happened to Troy is not outside here, because that's what he's really saying. He's saying in a war, I can do anything. In a war, there's no Geneva Conventions. In a war, there's no convention against torture. In a war, there's nothing about no law at all. I can do whatever I want. I can pick up you tomorrow, put you in a brig, torture you and do whatever I want, and it can be justified in the name of national security.
What about the ticking time bomb theory, the idea that if there's a ticking time bomb, you can do anything to a person who can tell you how to where it is?
The famous law school hypothetical, for which they have never actually found one. But once you open the door to that, as everybody who studies this issue, it opens it to thousands of people being tortured. And that isn't what this memo is about. This memo isn't saying ticking time bomb. This memo is saying, as a general matter, the president is exempt from using laws that prohibit torture, is exempt from those laws.
During recent Supreme Court testimony, the Bush administration said that they were not using torture. Did they lie to the Supreme Court?
It was an extraordinary hearing. Justice Ginsburg turns to Paul Clement, the assistant solicitor, and says, well, what if you used mild torture? Paul Clement says, well, the United States doesn't engage in torture. And then the key words to me in this whole thing, trust us, trust us. That's the way our government is trying to sell its war in Iraq, the abuse in Abu Ghraib, what's happening in Guantanamo, trust us. Well, it's obvious they can't be trusted. They can't be trusted at all. They need a court looking at them. They need Congress looking at them. And then they need the people of America going after them.
We're talking to Attorney Michael Ratner. We'll be back with him in a minute.
My country isn't free. We build our military from sea to sea. Spread like a virus blight with all our taxes' might. From cops and guards who shoot on sight to the weapons industry. Our bombs are smart and fast. Our tanks are built to last longer than schools. Behind a prison fence languish the dissidents who speak of peace and common sense, rights over rules.
My country isn't free. Samsara, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. As we continue our conversation with Attorney Michael Ratner. Michael, you are headed to Washington right now. You're filing a lawsuit, another one?
Right. I can't really talk about it today until 1 o'clock when I go to Washington, but we're going to be filing a major lawsuit involving these torture allegations. We just want to really, right now is a time really to put pressure on this administration so that everything gets exposed about what's going on so we can really put a stop to it and let the American people know how essentially lawless this administration is right now.
What do you understand is happening on Guantanamo? I mean, the information that we have is that General Miller, who was in charge of Guantanamo, was brought to Abu Ghraib, that among his recommendations, bring in the dogs, actually the dogs.
He was sent there to Gitmoize Abu Ghraib. That was the word they used. They were not doing as well in Iraq, supposedly, as they could on interrogations. He had been using certain interrogation techniques in Guantanamo. He goes in August 2003 to Abu Ghraib. 2 months later, what do we see but those famous photographs that took place in the next 2 months? The memo we're talking about, that memo of April 2003 that's on the website, is the one that is really about Guantanamo. Those interrogation techniques, if and when we can get a hold of them, those are what were used in Guantanamo. And they became apparently the model for what was used in Iraq.
Now, you've represented people in Guantanamo, whatever that means right now, given their lack of access to lawyers. But what have people told you about what happened
there?
Well,
I did see two of my clients, Shafiq and Razul, in the United Kingdom. They were released because what they did is they falsely confessed to meeting Osama bin Laden when their pictures were shown, the government claimed it was their pictures in a video. After 3 months of interrogations, 3 months of isolation, dogs, chained to the floor for 12 hours, food deprivation, the whole business, loud noises, they falsely confessed. Only after British intelligence proved that they were in England at the time the video was made were they released. It just shows you, first of all, how useless this kind of stuff is, how harmful it is, and that we shouldn't ignore what's happening in Guantanamo, even though we're very focused on Iraq right now.
The vice president's office, what relation does it have to this?
Well, that's a good question. Again, it's very hidden in a lot of this material, although I did see a reference to some people in the vice president's office having some knowledge of this.
I'm looking at Talking Points memo by Josh Marshall, saying, quoting the Wall Street Journal, to protect subordinates, should they be charged with torture, the memo advised Mr. Bush issue a presidential directive or other writing that could serve as evidence, since authority to set aside the laws is inherent in the president. Marshall of TalkingPointsMemo.com says, so the right to set aside law is inherent in the president. That claim alone should stop everyone in their tracks and prompt a serious consideration of the safety of the American Republic under this president. It is the very definition of a constitutional monarchy, let alone a constitutional republic, that the law is superior to the executive, not the other way around. This is the essence of what the rule of law means, a government of laws, not men, and all that.
The totalitarian position that the government has taken in that memo we referred to, he's exactly right, that when you can set aside all law, what are you saying except that you're a dictator? I mean, that's what is saying boldly, openly, and it's about time the American people did something about it.
And what do you think that the American people can do right now?
Well, one thing they should do is just keep hitting everybody. We want to get every document out. We want a special prosecutor, which is what I think ought to happen here, to look at the highest levels. All of these little investigations going on around seven lower-level soldiers in Abu Ghraib, you know, that's just not what this is about anymore. It's clear that the opening to lawlessness in this administration came from the very top. It came not just in the memos we're talking about. It came in that early Gonzales, counsel to the president, memo to the president, apparently, that said you can ignore the Geneva Conventions in Afghanistan and you can ignore them because we don't want to be subjected to war crimes. This stuff goes all the way up. We've got to get to the bottom of it. It's I consider it a major crisis of the republic, a major crisis of democracy.
The New York Times has in its final paragraph in a piece on the torture memo, the March memorandum also contains a curious section in which the lawyers argued that any torture committed at Guantanamo would not be a violation of the anti-torture statute because the base was under American legal jurisdiction and the statute only concerns torture committed overseas. That view is in direct conflict with the position the administration's taken in the Supreme Court, where it's argued prisoners at Guantanamo are not entitled to constitutional protections because the base is outside American jurisdiction.
This was one of my favorite parts of the reading. As one of the lawyers who represents the Guantanamo detainees, the government comes into court and says, we have no jurisdiction over Guantanamo. It's outside the sovereignty of the United States. Courts can't hear any cases coming out of Guantanamo. But for purposes of the criminal statute prohibiting torture, because it only applies outside the United States, they're going to make the argument that Guantanamo now is inside the United States in terms of that statute. So you don't have to, I mean, you don't have to go very much farther to say they're doing nothing but manipulating the law to essentially allow themselves to be not prosecuted for torture and to allow themselves to essentially leave people in total legal limbo out on Guantanamo. That's an extraordinary moment we've reached. I mean, really the worst that I've seen in this republic really since I've been a lawyer.
We've been doing a series this week remembering the dead. In the wake of the death of former President Ronald Reagan, who will be buried on Friday. As we talk about torture, let's go back several decades to the torture manuals. You have been involved in a series of lawsuits through the Center of Constitutional Rights suing the U.S. government. Can you talk about the Reagan era?
Well, I spent 8 years, really, of my life fighting everything and everything Reagan did in Central America. We brought lawsuits in El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Grenada, each area in which the president really used troops illegally, in which there was torture going on. The torture memo in particular, I mean, the torture book in particular, it came out of the School of the Americas, which instructed Latin American dictators and others in torture. That kind of stuff was going on with the Contras in Nicaragua. One of our clients, Ben Linder, who was killed by the Contras, a young man building a dam, an engineer in Nicaragua, many people think was tortured while he was lying on the ground. It was used in Central America. It was used in Nicaragua. So, and we tried to put an end to it. They withdrew it. And then now we see this going again.
A torture manual, you mean?
A manual of how you do torture. You know, what do? You sit the person in the chair, you put him in a funny position, you use electroshock, you use, you know, you threaten his family, you do all that
kind
of stuff.
And this was given to the Contra rebels?
This was given out by the CIA to interrogators in Nicaragua. That's correct. And so this is apple pie, unfortunately, for many of our intelligence agencies. We thought we maybe had created some space that it wasn't happening, and now we see not only is it happening, but it's being justified. In other words, when you caught the CIA with this torture manual, that was embarrassing. But they didn't try and say the president has the power to torture people. Here, that's what they're saying. The president has the power by directive to torture people. But really, when I see what's going on with Reagan right now, and I see the slaughter that took place in Nicaragua, we brought a case about a woman named Myrna Cunningham, who was a doctor, Mosquito Indian doctor in northern Nicaragua, suing Reagan and all his cohorts, saying they basically backed the Contras and they backed them in a war of terror and torture. She was raped scores of times purposely as a form of torture to discourage her from supporting the Sandinistas. That's the man who died. That's the man who was responsible for what happened in Nicaragua.
How was President Reagan responsible for that?
Well, at the highest levels, what they did was back the Contras, set up an illegal Contra force to go into Nicaragua, fight against the legitimate government of Nicaragua. Then when you had a Boland Amendment come down, an amendment prohibiting U.S. aid into the Contras, Reagan essentially, with a plan with Oliver North and others, went around that amendment, that restriction, and still illegally funded the Contras. In fact, we brought a lawsuit trying to compel prosecution of Reagan for that. And then, of course, it led to Iran-Contragate, which was the trading of missiles to Iran, the money then diverted to the Contras. Reagan's little memo book says in it, sold missiles to Iran. Completely illegal under the law to sell missiles at that time to Iran, completely illegal to fund the Contras. And here's what we did. We basically set up this force, trained them in the United States, sent them into Nicaragua, slaughtered thousands of people, and overturned the government. I mean, is that the man we're honoring today?
Yesterday, we also talked about Guatemala, but you brought a lawsuit against the general who had General Gramajo, who'd been the defense minister.
Right. General Gramajo was responsible for, we believe, for at least 10,000 deaths in Guatemala, Conjobol Indians. We sued him when he was being recycled as a potential new president of Guatemala. He was being recycled at the Kennedy School. We sued him on behalf of victims that their stories are so awful that you can't describe them on the air. Really just of people just being murdered, hung from trees, skin torn off, young children killed. And this is a general supported by our government, supported by Reagan, recycled at the Kennedy School. Again, we sued them successfully at that point and really essentially ended Gramajo's career as a possible presidential candidate in Guatemala. But this is what we think about. In El Salvador, we did the same thing. Remember, in El Salvador, there was a law that prohibited aiding the government if it was engaged in gross violations of human rights. Reagan, every 6 months, would certify they're not engaged in gross violations of civil rights. This was despite hundreds, hundreds, and hundreds of killings in El Salvador.
And what were the results of your lawsuits?
Well, most of them, the ones for damages, to some extent, won. The one against Gramajo won, although he never collected the money. The ones that really tried to stop this essentially lost. The government taking the position that we had no right to go into a court, that this was national security, that there was no right to bring these kind of cases. But they were important cases, I think, during that period to demonstrate to the world and to the American public that what we were doing in those countries was not only flatly illegal, but was gross, gross violations of people's human rights. I mean, this was one of the worst slaughters this country has engaged in for 8 solid years in terms of people, as well as in terms of what it meant for people's self-determination in those areas. And the idea that today, when I saw that they may want to put this guy's picture on a dollar bill, I mean, what does that tell you, a $10 bill? I mean, you know, I'm going to have to hold that murderer's dollars in my hands every day. I mean, it's astounding to me.
From your perspective, is legal recourse or taking to the streets more effective?
I think you need everything. I mean, I don't think law alone and going into the courts is going to get us that far. When I file a case, it's really to support people's movements in the streets, people's actions, and to show them that there's other means to fight. I'm a lawyer. It's one way I fight, but I also fight in the streets. You don't win cases outside of what's happening in the streets and outside of popular opposition to a government. You hope that cases and lawsuits, which not only help the people bringing them and strengthen the people who are the plaintiffs in the cases, but also will add to the whole mix of things that make it possible to really change the course of what a government is doing. And we came close in many cases in Central America, but in the end, you know, you have to face it. The Democrats were as guilty almost as the Republicans for what happened in Central America.
Michael Ratner, we have a tape from the Republican convention of 2000. I was able to catch up with Oliver North, who was there covering the convention, and I'd like you to comment on it.
Oliver North. Hi, I'm Amy Goodman from
Hello, Amy.
The High.
How are you?
So what do you think of Cheney as a choice for vice president?
Perfect.
Why do you like him?
Well, because he's going to make a great vice president.
What do you like most about him?
Just exactly that.
Well, you had dealings with him during Iran-Contra days. He was very much against the ban on funding of the Contras.
Yes, he was. Thank God. Yeah.
How did he help you?
Well, he helped. He helped the cause of democracy by making sure that we ended up with freedom and democracy in Nicaragua. Otherwise, it'd still be a communist country.
What about the getting aid to the Contras, even though the Congress had said that it was not legal?
Well, that's not what the Congress said at all.
Well, the Boland Amendment cut off funding for aid.
I would commend you to go back and read it, because one of the things we in the media ought to be is accurate. And the Boland Amendment simply said you couldn't use federal money to support the Nicaraguan resistance for military or paramilitary activities. And so the president didn't. He wouldn't use the King of Saudi Arabia, Governor of Taiwan, Governor of South Korea, the Sultan of Brunei, and of course the Ayatollah. So that's not American taxpayer money. And surprisingly enough, of all that went on in that 5 years of investigations, no one was ever prosecuted for violating the Boland Amendment.
Cheney, he tried to get rid of the Boland Amendment to make it legal?
No, he voted. Remember, the Congress voted five times in aid of the Nicaragua resistance. And four of those five times, they provided millions and millions of taxpayer dollars for it. Only once did they vote the wrong one.
And how did Cheney vote on that?
He voted the right one. Unfortunately, with a minority.
So what do you think he could accomplish today, then?
I think he'd make a great vice president. I think he is going to make a great vice president.
That was Oliver North in 2000. Very briefly, Michael Ratner, your response.
Well, just recall that Oliver North was convicted of various criminal charges for what happened with Iran-Contragate. It was overturned on appeal. But what he says is really incredible to me about Cheney. I mean, if Cheney was involved in this at all, it would be amazing, because this was all an illegal plan to divert money to the Contras. And that Oliver North can sit there and justify it and say that somehow this wasn't against what Congress meant is really amazing to
me.
He
said that they could get private money or money from other governments as long as it wasn't from the U.S. Congress.
Right. Then you have to ask yourself why Poindexter and North were convicted and overturned on technicalities on appeal if they could do that. In fact, what they did is the Boland Amendment wasn't a criminal statute, so obviously you're not going to be prosecuted by the Boland Amendment, but it was a prohibition. And to read the Boland Amendment that way is completely, just utterly erroneous. I mean, it basically said you can't aid the Contras, and these guys went ahead and did it. That's what they did.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Attorney Michael Ratner, headed now to Washington, D.C. to file yet another lawsuit against the U.S. government, this around torture. And we'll bring you the story of that lawsuit tomorrow on Democracy Now! Thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
Well, as we continue our series on remembering the dead, we're going to look at the policies of the Reagan administration in the Middle East, specifically during the Iran-Iraq War. That conflict lasted the better part of the 1980s and was one of the most bloody in modern times. More than a million people were killed, chemical weapons were used, and two of the most ancient societies on Earth devastated. Now, with Saddam Hussein removed from power and U.S. forces occupying the country, that war is seldom talked about. But the role Washington played in the Iran-Iraq War continues to impact the people and politics of the country. President George W. Bush labeled both countries part of an axis of evil. But Bush has never acknowledged the fact that when his father was vice president in Ronald Reagan's White House, Washington was aggressively arming both Iran and Iraq. Yesterday, we had the opportunity to speak with renowned Iranian judge Shireen Ebadi, Nobel Peace Prize winner. In October 2003, she was awarded the prize, becoming the first Muslim woman and the first Iranian to receive this award. She joined us in our Firehouse studio after yesterday's program to talk about Iran, the U.S., Islam, and democracy. Today, we'll just play an excerpt of this interview. I talked with Judge Ebadi about the relationship of Saddam Hussein to Iran and how Saddam stayed in power for so long. Her answers are translated from Farsi.
Saddam در سال 1359 به ایران حمله کرد.
Saddam attacked Iran in 1980.
و فکر میکرد که چون کشور ایران تازه توش انقلاب رخ داده بنابراین خیلی راحت میتونه ایران رو اشغال بکنه.
He was under the impression that because Iran was going through revolutionary process and it was unstable that he could easily invade and occupy the country.
اما ایرانی ها خصوصا جوانان ایرانی بسیار شجاعانه جنگیدن.
But contrary to his expectation, Iranians, particularly the young people, united and resisted his invasion.
فراموش نکنیم صدام چند بار ایران رو بمباران شیمیایی کرد.
We have to remember that Saddam used chemical bombs against Iranians a number of times.
و در اون موقع متوجه شدیم که صدام بمب‌های شیمیایی رو از آمریکا و ممالک غربی میگیره. به همه دنیا اعلام کردیم. منتها کسی حرف ما رو گوش نمی‌کرد.
At the time we had the information that Saddam was getting his nuclear material from the United States and other Western countries and we informed many countries and the international community about this problem but no one paid attention to our complaints.
و بعدن ثابت شد که حرف ما درسته.
And later on it was proven that our claims were quite correct.
و خیلی متاسفم همون هایی که به صدام بمب شیمیایی دادند بعد خودشون به بهانه اینکه صدام بمب شیمیایی داره برای حمله کردند.
It's regrettable that the same people who gave Saddam chemical material to make his bombs used his possession of chemical, you know, weapons as a disguise to attack him.
The country, the United States, is learning a lot or not about the Reagan years right now with the death of former President Ronald Reagan. I wanted to ask you about Donald Rumsfeld. He was the envoy for President Reagan in 1983 and 1984. He went to Iraq, shook hands with Saddam Hussein at the same time. In his two trips, the UN and the US State Department came out with a report saying Saddam had used chemical weapons. But Donald Rumsfeld was there to normalize relations with Saddam Hussein. Can you comment on this?
Game was bad as
من قبلا به شما گفتم صدام کسی نبود که بتواند اون ذرات خانه عظیم و اون بمب‌های شیمیایی رو بدون کمک آمریکا داشته باشه.
This was truly the case. Saddam Hussein was not able to accumulate the kind of weapon system and arsenals as well as chemical weapons without assistance of the United States and other Western countries.
منتها مسئله که مهمه ما بایستی گذشته رو دائما به مردم یادآوری بکنیم.
What is important is that we have to remind people of recent or past history.
نه به خاطر اینکه کینه ورزی بکنیم.
Not because we are seeking revenge.
بلکه به خاطر اینکه اشتباهات گذشته تکرار نشه.
But because we have to learn from the past so same mistakes will not be committed.
Nobel Peace Prize winner Shireen Ebadi speaking to Democracy Now. She was translated by Mansour Farhan, the former Iranian ambassador to the United Nations. This is Democracy Now. When we come back, we'll look at how the U.S. armed Saddam Hussein through the 1980s. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we take a look at the Reagan years in relation to Iran and Iraq, it was the Reagan administration that brought Iraq back into the American fold after years of isolation. U.S. relations with Iraq had been severed since the 67 Arab-Israeli War. But in 1982, as the Iran-Iraq War escalated, the Reagan administration removed Iraq from the list of nations that allegedly sponsored terrorism. This permitted Reagan to sell Saddam Hussein weapons, and Iraq began a buying frenzy. According to a February 1991 Los Angeles Times article, first on Hussein's shopping list was helicopters. He bought 60 Hughes helicopters and trainers with little notice. However, a second order of 10 twin-engine Bell Huey helicopters, like those used to carry combat troops in Vietnam, prompted congressional opposition in August 1983. Nonetheless, the sale was approved. In 1984, according to the LA Times, the State Department, in the name of increased American penetration of the extremely competitive civilian aircraft market, pushed through the sale of 45 Bell 214ST helicopters to Iraq. The helicopters, worth some $200 million, were originally designed for military purposes. The New York Times later reported that Saddam, quote, transferred many, if not all, of these helicopters to his military. In 1988, Saddam's forces allegedly attacked Kurdish civilians with poisonous gas from Iraqi helicopters and planes. U.S. intelligence sources told the L.A. Times in 1991 they, quote, believe that the American-built helicopters were among those that dropped the deadly bombs. In response to the gassing, sweeping sanctions were unanimously passed by the U.S. Senate that would have denied Iraq access to most U.S. technology. The measure was killed by the Reagan White House. Senior officials later told reporters they did not press for punishment of Iraq at the time because they wanted to shore up Iraq's ability to pursue the war with Iran. Alan Friedman is with us, the author of Spider's Web, The Secret History of How the White House Illegally Armed Iraq. Alan Friedman exposed what became known as Iraqgate while reporting for the Financial Times. He speaks to us from London. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Alan.
Thank you very much.
Can you go through this period with us?
Sure. What we're looking at is we need to put this into its historic context. So what I'd like to do for your listeners is talk about how Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush and James Baker, who was Secretary of State, and Robert Gates, who was CIA director in the 1980s, how they let what was called a tilt policy in favor of Iraq and against Iran in the 80s develop, what they thought the strategic reasons were for the United States to be doing that, and then the sad story of how it got out of control, how Vice President Bush was deeply personally involved in illegal arms transfers to Saddam Hussein in the late 80s that shouldn't have happened, and how the Bush administration, that's Bush 1, then proceeded with the help of Boynton Gray as White House General Counsel and others to cover up a scandal that, in my judgment, was significantly larger than Watergate. Let's put it into historical context. In the early 1980s and throughout the mid-1980s, the Reagan White House wasn't just busy defeating the so-called evil empire of the Soviet Union and outspending and bankrupting the Soviets. They were also engaged in a Middle East policy in Iraq and Iran that was aimed at obviously trying to defeat and neutralize the Khomeini, Ayatollah Khomeini, Islamic fundamentalists of Iran, who obviously were America's perceived enemy at the time. It's completely another story as to whether engagement, trade, and cultural exchange with Iran would have then and would today be a more positive way of bringing Iran into the international community than focusing on them as an enemy, but this is history. What happened was that these helicopter sales to Iraq, together with a whole series of other equipment sales that, by the way, weren't just the United States. The French government of Jacques Chirac sold lots of missiles and helicopters to Iraq as well. But this was grounded in a philosophy that Reagan and Bush had, which was to defeat Iran, we will fortify Saddam. He may be a killer, he may be a butcher, but he's our guy. And we're going to use him to keep a balance of power, which turned into a balance of terror between Iran and Iraq. What that meant was that in order to get around U.S. law, which says you can't conduct illegal secret covert operations without presidential directives, approvals, and disclosure to the Senate oversight committees, rogue operations very similar to the Iran-Contra operation, and indeed, in many cases involving the same CIA front companies in Virginia, the same shippers from Florida and Louisiana, the same people who worked with Ollie North on the Iran-Contra scandal, were also involved on getting arms to Iraq in the 80s, and they did this in the following way. They let a small Atlanta, Georgia branch of an Italian bank received taxpayers' money in the form of U.S. Department of Agriculture credits that the United States provided for Iraq, totaling $5 billion, B for boy, dollars, that went to Saddam Hussein with the knowledge of the CIA and the White House, which turned a blind eye, because they thought they had to find a way to help Iraq against Iran. Now, that Iraq-Iran war, in part thanks to U.S. assistance for Saddam Hussein, went years longer than it should have done and resulted in 1 million men, women, and children dying. 1 million people died in the Iran-Iraq war. And Reagan and Bush probably have blood on their hands, because if they hadn't sent all the military equipment to Iraq, fewer people would have died. When the war between Iran and Iraq ended, and we were already in 88, 89, 90, the Bush administration, the same policies continued, the CIA was reinforced, and this stuff kept going. In my investigations and those I conducted with Ted Koppel of ABC Nightline, and which Bill Sapphire of New York Times was active in exposing as well, we not only discovered this illegal set of shipments to Saddam Hussein with the blessing of the Bush White House, but we discovered that the thing got out of control, and the weapons kept going. And we're talking about elements that go well beyond helicopters and include the building blocks of nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction, inertial navigation systems, and unconventional weapons like rock-eye cluster bombs from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, that found their way to Saddam Hussein thanks to George Herbert Walker Bush and his CIA and their illegal shipments using U.S. taxpayer money. Strong words. All of it documented, all of it little focused upon as America pays tribute to Ronald Reagan's death and somehow makes him into a hero, when indeed his and Bush's policies, in my judgment, resulted in major loss of life and major strategic errors by the United States that they then sought to cover up later on.
As we look at the 1980s, Donald Rumsfeld as Reagan envoy, reported by my colleague Jeremy Scahill here at Democracy Now! In his piece, The Saddam and Rumsfeld's Closet, in 83 and 84, goes to Iraq, meets with Saddam Hussein at the time when the UN and State Department reports had come out saying that Saddam Hussein had used gas. He wasn't there to condemn Saddam Hussein for this, but to normalize relations. Can you talk about these
meetings? Can I interrupt you and tell you what Don Rumsfeld did in Baghdad? Don Rumsfeld went to Baghdad, was met by Saddam Hussein at the airport. That's right, Donald Rumsfeld. And with a big Rumsfeld grin on his face, said, "I'm really glad to be here in Baghdad with my good friend Saddam Hussein," and proceeded to carry messages back and forth for the Reagan administration of active military and economic support for Saddam Hussein. I think it's important, you don't need to be a conspiracy theorist, because there's a lot of loony people who make up stories. You just need to look at the facts to understand that the same Rumsfeld and the same Bush advisors, the coterie of CIA and military types who've been around the family of the father and are now in the administration in the son, are the same people who built up Saddam Hussein as our guy and turned a blind eye at his atrocities and slapped him on the back, literally, physically. Rumsfeld, in his jovial way, slapped Saddam on the back and said, "Great to do business with Iraq, our friend." And they're the same people who, of course, used CIA funds to support Osama bin Laden in the late 70s and early 80s in Afghanistan to fight the Soviet Union. We create these monsters. Then, when it's not convenient, we cover them up. And the press, unfortunately, in America is not what it used to be and has forgotten how to investigate criminal acts by the White House. So that's where we are today.
Rumsfeld brought Saddam Hussein from Ronald Reagan golden cowboy spurs and pistols.
He brought presents like those. And again,
I was wondering if the pistol that now George W. Bush shows to friends just off the Oval Office that soldiers had given to him that they had gotten from Saddam Hussein's one of his offices or palaces, perhaps is the one that Reagan gave to him.
I think that's unlikely. I think it's a different pistol. But I think the real bottom line here is that if you want a sense of the depth of this involvement, let me mention a couple of things. Alexander Haig and Bobby Ray Inman, two names from the 80s, who were associated with the Reagan era. Bobby Ray Inman did not become Secretary of Defense under Reagan and Bush because Bill Sapphire and Ted Koppel and I exposed the fact that Bobby Ray Inman, Admiral Bobby Ray Inman of Defense Intelligence Agency, had been paid by one of the companies that shipped Rockeye cluster bombs to Iraq, and he couldn't get out of that allegation because it was documented and the Senate failed to confirm him at the time. It was a cowboy mentality at the time, and I think it unfortunately created the framework and set the stage for the tragedy we've seen in recent days, weeks, and months.
Alan Friedman, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Alan Friedman is the author of Spider's Web, The Secret History of How the White House Allegedly Armed Iraq. And we will also post on our website our full hour interview that we did with Alan Friedman in the last year. And that's at democracynow.org. There you can also hear and see our interview with Michael Franti, the hip-hop artist who has gone from Iraq to the occupied territories. We'll bring you his full interview where he was in Iraq. We continue our Exception to the Rulers tour on Thursday in Hamden, Connecticut. We'll be at the Spring Glen United Church of Christ with the American Friends Service Committee. You can get more information on our website. And on Saturday, looking forward to seeing WPFW listeners as well as Public Access TV Channel 5 in Baltimore viewers at the Unity United Methodist Church, 1433 Edmondson Avenue. That is Saturday, June 12th at 7:30 p.m. You can see more at our website, democracynow.org/book. And you can see the Exception to the Rulers tour. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.